I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics.
This week, we're talking about the first indictments in Robert Mueller's investigation into possible collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, and evangelical leaders' response to this news.
And for our deep dive on Reformation Day, we discuss the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, the state of the divorce between Catholics and Protestants, and particularly how the split has played out in American politics.
Before we get to our main stories, we'll each start with a quick hit on a story that we've been following. Amy, what has grabbed your attention this week?
Well, Nish, as you may or may not have noticed, it's Halloween week.
Halloween today, even, when we're recording.
Oh, my goodness. But it's been Halloween for 3 weeks. Can we be real about this?
And it's going to be Halloween for a while with my candy stash.
This is going to be my, like, in my day rant, because in my day, you dressed up on Halloween. There are like 3 weekends worth of things for kids to wear their costumes for. By the time Halloween actually rolls around, they've worn their costumes 7 or 8 times. And I won't say they're tired of it because they're getting candy, but it's a little too much. Anyway, and old timer rant.
At least they're getting their money's worth out of their costume.
Well, yes, there is that. You can argue that. Anyway, we're going to have a very happy little Hermione and a teddy bear running around this evening.
So cute.
Looking forward to that. What are your kids doing?
Rowan is going as Rowan. He has decided he does not want to wear a costume.
He is very good Rowan.
He is a very good Rowan. For those who don't know, my son is autistic and is very opposed to costumes. Just not here for it. So he's like, I think I'm just going to go as Rowan. I'm like, I think that's a great idea. And then Scout, my 4-year-old daughter, is going as Kylo Ren, the new villain from the Star Wars movies. And she got her Kylo Ren costume actually as a bribe. In order to get her to wear a dress to my brother's wedding, I promised her that she could wear a Kylo Ren costume to the reception, but she also wanted to wear it for Halloween. So, like I said, getting some use, getting that money's worth out of that costume this year.
I love that.
So that is going to be our house with, oh my gosh, I bought so much candy. So much candy.
I actually have to go out and get some more because I assigned that job and we're going to run out in like the first 15 minutes, I tell you.
Oh no. Oh no.
Gotta do it yourself. Anyway, back to the news. On the subject of Halloween, what grabbed my attention this morning was a story in Vice. And by the way, you and I have discussed the fact that Vice, oddly, has started doing religion stories and really good religion stories, too.
That's awesome.
So there was a piece by an ex-evangelical, I think, about the trend of hell houses.
Oh, gosh.
In evangelical churches as kind of an alternative to haunted houses.
You're going to have to explain that for those who did not grow up in evangelical culture, Amy.
Yeah, well, I got to say, this was past my time in evangelical culture because I think it became a thing more with megachurches when you had bigger, just bigger physical plants that could house these things. When I was growing up in the 70s and the 80s in a Baptist church, we were just very strongly encouraged to skip Halloween because it was pagan and it was demons and witches and those were all bad things, which...
But did you have a harvest festival?
We did not.
Did you get to celebrate the fall?
No.
I know some churches are doing that now. Instead of having Halloween stuff, they'll do like a harvest, you know, so you get to celebrate all the fall stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, even back then, that did not fly with kids. We still went trick-or-treating. Except for the 1 year when it overlapped with Wednesday night services. And I don't remember how we finessed that, but I'm pretty sure we showed up in costume to Wednesday night.
Well played.
Anyway, so this apparently was first a brainchild of Jerry Falwell Sr. in the 1970s, but it was pretty limited. And it didn't take off until the 90s and the 2000s when megachurches became huge and they made this like an annual kind of invite your friends, bring all the neighbors into church, part of their ministry. And it was also not part of the move into social conservatism and really engaging in political issues like abortion and gay marriage because some of them wrapped those issues in. You would have some fetuses in hell houses, which I mean, not actual fetuses, but, you know, reproductions. And, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah. The idea was to scare kids into Christianity, which we can do a whole episode sometime, and we will. And we've talked a little bit about how fear really drives and is a strong undercurrent through modern conservative evangelicalism these days. But it has a long, real history in Christianity, if not in evangelicalism. I mean, that's the inferno that Dante wrote about. And Puritans definitely tried to scare people into becoming Christians with their development of ideas about hell, which does not appear in the Bible. And so evangelical churches has kind of taken this onto their own. And this article, which I recommend folks look into themselves, just kind of walks through the more modern history of it and how scarring it can be to be a young teenager who has experience walking through hell houses and having Christianity presented to you in that form as something that you should make a permanent part of your life, not because you are needing Jesus to be your personal savior and Christ, but because you are scared of the alternative.
They're literally scaring the hell out of you.
Yep. Literally scaring the hell out of you. I think we can agree that's not our version of Christianity, but
no, not mine anyway.
It's effective, at least. It gets you converts.
Yeah, well, there is that.
So there's a bunch of what really makes this Vice video are the or the piece are the videos that go along with it. Little scenes that you might encounter in the hell houses, which watching those definitely made me happy that our little Baptist church never did this, because I would never have been the same. I really couldn't even sit through 101 Dalmatians because Cruella de Vil just scared me too much. So I might have been turned off by church completely.
Aw, Amy, that is incredible. I can't believe those are still a thing.
They are. And Nish, I couldn't help but think as I was reading through this about what you were telling me recently about Utah and Salt Lake City in particular being like the hub of haunted houses in the U.S. Can you share a little bit about that? Because I was completely unaware of this part of Mormonism and Mormon culture.
I was completely unaware of this part of Utah culture before I moved here. We were shocked when we moved to Salt Lake City that Halloween is up there with Christmas in how people prepare. It is unbelievable. People turn their homes into these like walkthrough kind of DIY haunted houses that you have to go through to get your candy. There are these giant properties and warehouses in downtown Salt Lake City, prime real estate, that operate as a haunted house for like a month, maybe a month and a half every year, usually around Halloween time, right? And then they're empty the rest of the year because they make all of their money in this like 1.5 months. It is crazy. We get hundreds of trick-or-treaters to our house, and we live in a pretty affluent neighborhood of downtown Salt Lake City. And it's on a grid, so it's very easy to navigate. It's residential, and I get why a lot of people come up here. But I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how many trick-or-treaters we had. I was actually just talking with a friend recently, and I told her, I think I told you this morning too, that like I'm actually sort of surprised that kids don't get the day off of school for this holiday. Like, that's how big of a deal it is in Utah. It's amazing. All the kids go to school in costume, and it's just this whole thing. The whole town is just like decorated and ready for Halloween. It's bizarre. I mean, not that I'm complaining, because I've been eating Milky Ways for like a month, but it's kind of amazing. Halloween culture is its own thing here in Utah. And I don't know why. I've never quite gotten to the bottom of it. I think a lot of people have their different theories as to why. But the one that makes the most sense to me is Utah's very family friendly. Everyone here has tons of kids. It's just kind of Mormon culture. And so going trick-or-treating and doing Halloween-themed things and fall-themed things are just another way for you to spend time with your family and do things with your kids. So everything is pretty kid-friendly, aside from, you know, the very intense haunted houses. It's a pretty family-friendly activity. So in all the local wards, which are kind of small Mormon congregations, have their trunk-or-treat event that happens.
Right.
Yeah, like the night before.
Explain that.
It's essentially like all the parents park their cars in the church parking lot and open up their, you know, the trunk of their car, and they decorate the trunks of their car to look like all these different things, and then little kids can walk around the parking lot and go from car to car and get Halloween candy with all the people in their ward or in their church. So, you know, just like tons of fun little activities like that. But I mean, there's pumpkin patches and corn mazes and haunted corn mazes. And I mean, you name it, we've got it. It's crazy and fun, but crazy. I mean,
I'm all for fall. It is my favorite season. I'm kind of shocked, especially given how Halloween was viewed
right.
in my church. Not that I think of Baptists and Mormons as similar, but there is like a strain of keep it clean, you know.
The cultural overlap is very similar. Like there's a lot of cultural overlap.
Which is why I'm kind of blown away by this. But it does make me laugh. A very good friend of mine who's Mormon once told me that because there really are no other vices available to Mormons, drinking or smoking or even caffeine. Although, did I read recently that Coke was going to be sold on one of the campuses?
Regular Coke is now sold at BYU, which stop the presses. That was an amazing day in Utah history.
The one vice that's available is like really sweet food, sugar.
Yes, so, and sodas. So, you know, we have these like...
It's pop-nish. It's not soda.
It's soda here, Amy. I'm sorry. Midwestern child. It is the one vice that people have here are sodas. And we have these stores, these like drive-through soda stands where you can get what we call dirty sodas. And people get like, you know, 64 ounces of like Diet Coke or Dr. Pepper with all these different flavor syrups mixed in. It's this whole culture.
I'd love to see the statistics on what the like diabetes.
Oh my God. It's going to be through the roof.
Utah versus other.
Oh yeah. Like these started about, they got really big about 2 years ago. And so I'm interested to see in like 10 to 15 years what the what the health of people is in Utah and how it declines. But super interesting. Anyway, Mormon culture, it's its whole thing. We could do a whole episode on it.
All right. We could, but we will not.
We will not.
Not right now, at least. So Nish, you have an update for us on one of our stories from last week.
Yeah. So last week we talked about an organization called Church Clarity, which developed a website of the same name that scored churches on how clearly they communicate their position on LGBTQ affirmation or inclusion. And I'm still following what's happening over there, and I thought I would give an update. Church Clarity is now saying that nearly 200 churches of varying sizes, denominations, and locations have been scored, and that number is growing daily. So they are getting just a mass influx of people wanting to submit churches for scoring, which is really interesting. And then today, as a way to mark the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, which we're talking about all throughout the podcast, Church Clarity has made posters available on their website that you can print and tape onto the doors of local churches as a way of asking them to make their LGBTQ positions more clear. So it's not like nailing a massive theological document to a door, but it's a clever idea to pursue their goal of moving churches toward being more open and honest about their positions. So what they're doing and their movement to getting churches to be more honest is working, and they've got, you know, some really clever ideas on how to make that happen. So I thought I'd give an update and say more and more churches are being scored. So super interesting.
And they were also written up in Vice.
They were written up in Vice. There's been a lot of coverage about Church Clarity. So good for them. And really interesting to see that kind of take off.
And unusual to see that kind of media savvy among a religious group.
Yeah, right. Well, there are some really brilliant marketing minds behind Church Clarity. I will say that. And so, I mean, clearly, like the Reformation idea was just really sharp.
That's a great one.
Really clever. Yeah. So Anyway, that is mine.
Well, let's move on and talk about the big stories of the week. Not that I can think of a big story. Is there anything that has happened this week?
Oh, my gosh.
So the obvious news that everyone is talking about is the indictments of former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort, his business partner Rick Gates, as well as a campaign foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos. And little side note here, for children of the 80s, the one true George Papadopoulos is the dad in 80s sitcom Webster.
That's exactly
we accept
right.
No alternatives. Oh, George Papadopoulos.
He's the only one we recognize.
Yes. So there's a lot of speculation about what these indictments mean, what comes next, and how it will affect the current administration. President Trump, not surprisingly, has been digging in his heels on Twitter, resolutely declaring there is no collusion, all in caps, no collusion,
exclamation point,
between the Trump campaign and Russia, and suggesting the real target should be crooked Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. Oh, Nish, I can barely wait. What are your thoughts?
Well, I have to tell you that Mueller Monday is now my favorite Monday. Yesterday was a really interesting day, though I must say that the news was moving so fast yesterday.
It was hard to keep up.
It was really hard to keep up, and everyone had on their like tinfoil hats and go-go gadget treason detectors that there was not enough Dr. Pepper in the world that could have kept me caffeinated enough to keep up with both the news and the commentary. It was moving at such a rapid pace.
You tried, though. You had multiple Dr. Peppers yesterday.
I did. And
that's how everybody knows it's a big deal.
It's like, how many Dr. Peppers in is Nish? I think I ended up quitting around like 1 o'clock and just eating chocolate because it was just too much information. It's like drinking from a fire hose. The thing that has been not surprising, like, let's be really clear, it's not surprising at all, but just fascinating to watch is, again, President Trump's response and almost like this willingness to or unwillingness to hear it. Like, he'll just kind of stick his fingers in his ears and la 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 la, right? Like, he just does not want to hear that this is really, really, really bad, like really bad for his administration. And so I don't know. I don't want to call it funny because it's a genuine threat to democracy if these investigations do go and show that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Like, that has massive implications across the board. So I don't want to call it funny by any stretch of the imagination, but still, I just look at President Trump and I'm like, really? Like,
it's absurd.
You seriously? It's absurd. And of course, we have the conservative news media propagandist machine of Fox News
covering emojis.
Covering emojis. Like,
that's what they were covering yesterday morning. Cheeseburger
right.
Emojis.
The Manafort indictment comes down. Every single news outlet is covering it wall to wall. I mean, just wall to wall coverage. And what is Fox News covering? The fact that the cheeseburger emoji now has cheese on it. Like, oh, what? Who? Oh my gosh. I just can't. I don't have it in me to deal with Fox News. So.
Yeah. Well, I think we can agree that the fact that Trump is disassociated from reality and not willing to either accept or admit, we can't tell which one it is, but let's say both, the import of this is not exactly a surprise. That's a dog bites man story, I guess. But you had mentioned, and we've certainly seen this elsewhere, that you've seen evangelicals on Facebook and other places really wanting to believe the spin coming out of at least the White House. Sarah Sanders' briefing yesterday was a thing to behold.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders is always a thing to behold.
Oh, but this was really...
I genuinely wonder if she worries that this is all going to... Like, that she is going to go down with this shit.
Yeah, I think you have to have passed that a long ways back.
It's just unbelievable to watch. Like, she's way worse than Sean Spicer was, in my opinion.
Well, somebody mentioned that this is like Iraqi press guy under Saddam. Baghdad Bob, was that what he was nicknamed?
Oh yeah, you're
who
right.
Who would just like could not be knocked off his message.
Right.
And
that's right.
You know, people made fun of it because he was the press person for a dictator. that's not, even in the worst of spin, that's not what we've seen in the U.S. at all. And it's the same kind of situation where it is absurd, but you can't laugh because it's so horrible that this is where we are at, that, you know, a White House press secretary can point at the sky and insist that it's not blue. But anyway, we've got a lot of folks out there wanting to believe that Manafort really didn't have anything to do with the Trump campaign, and that this guy Papadopoulos, he was just a like low-level intern who nobody knew. He volunteered for the campaign. Fortunately, we've got a record. We've got receipts that we can go back and look at. You've got Trump meeting with the editorial board of the Washington Post back in spring of 2016, when this was all just a weird hypothetical.
And praises him by name.
Yeah, he was rolling out, you know, trying to show that he was legit and that he did have people advising him on foreign policy. And it ended up actually working against the point that he wanted to make, because he couldn't really pull together legit foreign policy advisors. But named George Papadopoulos and said he was an excellent guy. He was proud to be able to say that this guy was supporting his campaign and advising him. Same thing with Manafort. You've got Sean Hannity tweeting that nobody should underestimate how much Paul Manafort did to really help this Trump campaign get to where it is now.
Right. Yeah.
In August of 2016.
Yep.
So these were not, at least Manafort certainly was not fringe. Manafort was in there next to Trump at every big meeting and behind the scenes. And importantly, this alone would be enough to really get everybody's notice, was in there working at the Republican convention trying to get the platform changed to be pro-Russian.
Right.
And succeeding.
The whole thing is just crazy. And like, Papadopoulos was instructed by high-level campaign officials to set up that back channel with Russia. Like, there's all sorts of crazy things that happened that you just can't, like, you really can't whitewash it. It just is what it is. And they just keep sticking their fingers in their ear.
This should be the thing that opens conservative evangelicals' eyes, right? Right?
Oh, well, you know, we thought that mocking a disabled reporter would do it. We thought calling immigrants and rapists would do it. We thought saying you can just grab women by the pussy would do it. We thought it all, right? So why in the world would something like a decorated and well-respected, historically Republican special investigator conducting a thorough investigation, why would his findings have any sway over this situation? So, of course, evangelicals are not turning on Trump. Jerry Falwell just retweeted everything that President Trump was saying, and saying that, like, we really need to focus on the Democrats. Like, look at the Dems, or, you know, whatever it was that he tweeted. And it just goes to show that, like, again, like Sarah Huckabee Sanders, right? They're going to go down with this ship, and they're not... there's nothing that's going to change their mind. I keep thinking that maybe something will with these guys that keep doubling down on their support with Trump, and yet nothing will. Because I honestly think that we're operating on two different planets. And what I mean by that is that we're not operating on a shared foundation of fact. We don't share the same, like, we don't have the same view of what the actual facts are, which is inherently insane, but here we are. And so when you can't even agree on what the facts are, how are you ever going to have a conversation about, you know, who has the right position and who has the wrong position when you're not even operating in the same plane of reality? So it's just been really discouraging to see evangelicals again double down, but I don't expect anything different.
Have you noticed anything from other folks who are out there? I mean, Jerry Falwell Jr., I guess I expect nothing else from him at this point, that he would double down. He has really hitched his wagon to Trump, and it's worked at least to raise his profile and get attention for being something other than his father's son, which is maybe all he really wanted out of this. You know, if we remember back, basically this time last year when the last debates were wrapping up, And I can't remember if it was the second or the third debate at this point, when Trump had been making noises about how the election was going to be rigged and maybe he wouldn't accept the results if he lost. And he was asked point blank about that in one of the debates and still hedged, like, well, you'll have to find out. And
his reality TV cliffhangers thing that he applies to policy in the United States, it just drives me insane. Anyway, continue. Sorry.
Yeah. So that was actually something that was criticized by fellow Republicans who said, you know, we have rules here and we believe in the sanctity of our elections and
the peaceful, you know,
whatever
transfer of power
result comes out. Yes, we will accept that. Now I'm going to forget. So I know David Duke was one of the first people out of the box after the debate saying, you know, he shouldn't have to accept it if it turns out that Hillary wins, because if she wins, it'll only be because the elections were rigged. But Jerry Falwell also was one of just two or three people who responded by supporting Trump on that and saying, you know, he has every right to contest the outcome of the election. Pretty much all the evidence we needed that there is nothing,
nothing
that Trump could do, save maybe killing the Falwell family dog, I don't know, that would turn Jerry Falwell on him. And yet, you know, the evangelical community, thank the Lord, is more than Jerry Falwell Jr. I haven't heard really anybody else speak up. And that's been the thing, is even if they don't come out and retweet the president, they don't come out and say he's wrong.
Right. That's right. Like, silence is complicity, right? Especially in these sorts of situations. And so looking, I mean, I kind of kept an eye on Robert Jeffress's Twitter feed. I kept an eye on a few others. And silence. Not many people have been saying things. Now, in my, you know, Twitter feeds amongst my, you know, friends, my Facebook feed amongst my acquaintances and personal friends, it's been a mix. You know, some people are, you know, saying, oh, this is pretty damning. But then those who are still very in their Fox News conservative bubble are saying, you know, this is nothing. It means nothing. We should really be investigating the Clintons. And I'm like, really? Because the Clintons are not in the White House. Like, I can't, why are we talking about still investigating Hillary Clinton? Like, she's not in public office. Neither is her husband. The Trump administration is in public office. And this is the job of the Congress. This is the job of, you know, all the branches of government, is to keep each other in check and, in, you know, keep that power in check. And that we would try to derail this by talking about his political adversary, whom he beat in an election. Like, why are we still pretending like he lost? It's just, the whole thing is so weird and bizarre. But yeah, as far as the evangelical leaders that have supported Donald Trump, it's been pretty quiet since the indictments have come out. And I'm interested to see if that changes as the weeks go on and as more information comes out and as the investigation moves forward. So just have to wait and see.
And we will. But in the meantime, we are recording today on a very special day. What is it, Nish?
That's right. We are recording this episode on October 31st, 2017. In the year of our Lord, which is also the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther, a German theologian, nailing his 95 theses to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg, Germany, which ignited the Protestant Reformation. Luther took issue with several teachings of the Catholic Church, the most pronounced being indulgences, a practice that, for all intents and purposes, allowed people to pay penance for their sins with money given to the church. Today, we're going to take a look into the current state of the divide between Catholics and Protestants and how that divide specifically has played out in American political and religious life. Amy, there was a lot of really fascinating pieces this week in the broader news media about the Reformation, the history of the Reformation, what's been happening with the Reformation since, you know, really in the last like 20, 30 years. And one of them that struck both of our attention was the one by Elizabeth Brunig in the Washington Post, where she talks about the dynamic between specifically American evangelicals and American Catholics. Did you read that piece? What did you think?
I did. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting. it raises a subject that is often overlooked as people focus on the political partnership between conservative evangelicals and conservative Catholics. And that's one thing I wish that she had emphasized. It's that this really is between conservative factions in those religious traditions. This is not overall. She points out the obvious fact that there are some existing theological differences between evangelicals and Catholics, but that for several decades, those have been kind of set aside as evangelicals and Catholics and even Mormons and I would say Orthodox Jews in some instances too have come together to form kind of an ecumenical coalition on the right for the purpose of politics and for the purpose of getting behind more conservative policies. And that has been kind of an interesting time in American history. It would be, I think, seen as a pretty positive example of unity, except that, as Elizabeth writes, it has come at the expense of really anybody who's not evangelical.
Evangelicals have railroaded everybody. That's really what it boils down
to. They've really set the agenda in terms of what the issues are and how you adhere to them. So, you know, just to take one example that comes up more in the states, I would say, than at the federal level, but the death penalty is something that obviously there's much more support for in the South, and there's so much racial background to all of this that we'll just have to stipulate and set aside for the moment. But Southern Baptists, because of the regional differences, have been very, very, very pro-death penalty and have been able to develop a theological justification for having the death penalty. Catholics, it is much more mixed. This has been something that's been in the news.
That's right. Pope Francis came out and spoke out about it, right?
Well, he said in an event a few weeks ago that this may be something that the church needs to reconsider. He basically indicated that the church catechism, which it is a big deal to change, might have to be altered to express actual opposition, full-throated opposition to the use of the death penalty. What has happened is that over the centuries, the Catholic Church has been open to the use of the death penalty. And the way they have always framed it is that every state should have the ability to maintain order and protect their citizens, and they should be able to use every means available to them. And that for states in which the death penalty is one of those means, then they should be able to use the death penalty, or at least have the threat of the death penalty, to establish order and as a deterrent. What, starting around with Pope John Paul II, happened was that the popes started pointing out that in modern society, in fact, states don't really have the need to use the death penalty. There are so many other ways to maintain order and to protect your citizens that you couldn't really make a case that you needed to have the death penalty in order to protect people. Punishment is an entirely different argument, and it's one that, starting with Pope John Paul and then Benedict and certainly now Francis, they have all indicated that that is not a good enough reason to use the death penalty, to have the death penalty on the books as a potential punishment. And so that's been something that has at least been wiggly enough that has allowed conservative Catholics and especially Republican Catholics to say, oh, well, if I support the death penalty, it's not really going against the church because the church doesn't officially have a position against the death penalty, which is true by the letter of the law, but it is not where the church has been headed. And Francis may, in fact, be provoking kind of a little standoff here, because what he's threatening would be to make that the actual position of the church, which would really make some of these guys, it would put them in a difficult position. So that's one of the examples of where, evangelicals have kind of led the way. But, you know, the other religious groups have gone along with them, and specifically Catholics in this instance.
Yeah, this is so interesting to me because, I mean, I don't know too much about the Catholic Church, even though my family history is very deeply Catholic. I have to say that as a former ex-evangelical, I don't really know what to call myself, but...
You're evangelical. It's okay.
But I would probably claim that label, but would the label claim me? That's the question, Amy. All that to say, I have to say that seeing some of these sort of tensions happening in the Catholic Church, I don't want to say like makes me happy. Like I don't like division at any level. Like, I mean, sometimes I think it's necessary and good and right. But I have to say it brings me, I guess, a little bit of kind of internal comfort to see some of the same tensions and some of the same issues coming up in the Catholic Church. Like there's a very conservative politically side to the Catholic Church and a very liberal side to the Catholic Church. And they kind of war against each other on some of these issues. We're seeing it now in the Catholic Church on the LGBT issue, just like we are in evangelicalism. And so I have to say, like, it brings me a weird sense of comfort to know that these issues are not exclusive to kind of evangelicals versus mainline, or even liberal and conservative evangelicals versus each other. That this is these sorts of issues and this sort of kind of political dynamic within faith communities is happening across the board. Would you say that that's true?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, there is an all-out civil war within Catholicism, and we will actually do a deep dive into that in an upcoming week.
Yes.
You know, but it has to be considered within a Catholic context. One thing that I took issue with in this piece in the Post was her use of the word evangelical she described a new breed of politically evangelicalized Catholic candidates and office holders. And there I felt like...
Right, because she put like Paul Ryan in there too, didn't she?
Yeah, well, evangelical there is using the definition created by the religious right and by Fox News. That's Fox News evangelicals, not evangelical the way you or I understand it, and not evangelical the way it is intended is a theological definition. So I took some issue with that, as I did with the focus purely on office holders. I mean, this did not come about because Catholic politicians decided that they needed to make common cause with evangelical politicians. The church leadership as well had a big role to play in this, and they have chosen to really focus on Catholic Democrats who have differed from the church on the issue of abortion, rather than take on Republican Catholics who differ from the church on 8 or 10 different issues, whether it's, you know, social welfare or the death penalty or healthcare this year. They were very much against Obamacare repeal, but you didn't see any Republican Catholics being threatened over that. And when I say threaten, you can go back to the 2004 presidential campaign when John Kerry wasn't sure if he'd be allowed to take communion every Sunday when he went to a church. It goes much earlier than that with these same kinds of excommunication threats or Democrats being kicked off of boards in their parishes, being uninvited from speaking at Catholic schools when the local Catholic leadership found out that they were going to be there. I mean, there has been definitely a concerted campaign. And, you know, church leaders are well within their rights to do it. My concern of following this, and this is something I've been writing about going back to grad school, is the inconsistency of it. And again, those church leaders would say, well, this is part of church teaching, is our opposition to abortion. Everything else, there's some allowance for differing views. And just to come full circle, this is what will make it so very interesting if the Catholic Church does also kind of codify its opposition to the death penalty, is suddenly that then raises the stakes for those church leaders of, okay, well, if you're going to lay down the law for Democrats who disagree with the church on abortion, will you do the same for Republicans? And if not, then how are you not a political church at this point, a partisan church, that is?
This is so interesting. And the one piece that I always seem to see as kind of a curveball when it comes to the Catholic Church is Pope Francis. Because Pope Francis, for all intents and purposes, is pretty liberal. Like, some of the things that he has said could be, I should say, I don't want to characterize him as liberal, but his statements and some of the things that he has come out in favor of would seem to be more in line with the political left, aside from abortion. Abortion would probably be the one place where he does align with the political right.
Right. Well, he would say that it's being whole life.
Right. That's exactly right. Which, you know, we talked about a little bit last week. And so I guess this is maybe a little bit of my naivete showing, is how much sway really does Pope Francis have? Because we've seen reports of, you know, cardinals coming out and, you know, being a little bit oppositional towards the Pope. What, I mean, he's the Pope, he's the head of the church. And so, how much is dissent or how much is differing opinion on some of these issues allowed, especially when it comes to statements that the Pope makes? Do you know, could you speak to that a little bit? Because that's something that always seems really interesting to me. I go, well, he said this, but then you got all these other people kind of not necessarily in lockstep with what he's saying. And doesn't that create some authoritarian tension, for lack of a better term?
Well, yeah, this is why I want to have somebody come and join us in the next few weeks to talk specifically about this. But I will say, yeah, he has dealt every step of the way since becoming Pope. Let's work that back. That was 5 years ago, specifically from kind of conservative right-wing corners of Catholicism, folks who have not questioned his legitimacy, but who have been kind of backpedaling in terms of the authority the Pope really has, or just, you know, outright disagreeing with him. And he's been kind of knocking people down, particularly in the last month. There have been a couple things. There was a cardinal in Africa who continues to speak out disagreeing with the Pope, and the Pope keeps continuing to say, no, he's wrong. By the way, I'm the Pope.
Right. Trump card. P.S. I'm the Pope.
So, yeah, it's one of the things that makes covering Catholics so fascinating right now. Is this is a really exciting time, you know, and in no other faith tradition is it's such a numbers game, in fact. And by that, I mean that for a long, long time, because John Paul had such a long papacy, and then Benedict kind of inherited a lot of the folks that he appointed, you had a leadership around the world that was shaped very much by conservative Catholics. And one of the things that Francis has done that hasn't gotten as much coverage as some of his more colorful statements is that he has been appointing bishops and archbishops and cardinals in his own image, to use a probably heretical.
Well, would we classify them as Jesuits? Because he is a Jesuit himself. Is that correct?
No. They are kind of Francis cardinals and Francis bishops. You know, right here in Chicago, our fairly new Cardinal Supich is definitely a Francis guy. And some of them are close to him personally. One thing I found out when he first became Pope, and I was kind of reporting on the American cardinals who are really close to him, is sometimes it comes down to their facility with Spanish and Italian, which is fascinating to me, because there's kind of a class of American clerics who have really, as the church was becoming more and more Latino, they, you know, became very fluent in Spanish because they were responding to who their community was. And they now turn out to be in a position to be much closer to the Pope because they can communicate with him in his native language. And the folks who didn't pay attention to that part of their changing church, there's a separation between them.
Back of the line for you.
Yeah. So I wrote about this with regard to Cardinal O'Malley in Boston, who's very close personally to Pope Francis, and who, you know, can email him directly and call his cell phone and talk to him, because the two of them can communicate completely in Spanish. And they also are very similar in terms of approach and bearing. And then somebody like Cardinal Burke, who, you know, this is kind of a setup, because I don't think Francis in any world was going to be able to get along with a Cardinal Burke. But Burke just cannot communicate with Francis in the same way. And the same, I believe, Cardinal Dolan has kind of the same trouble. So that's been kind of an interesting side note here to follow. But enough of side notes. We are almost out of time for this week. But before we go, every week we like to leave you with a recommendation or two, maybe a TV show, maybe a podcast, maybe a movie that we are following. Nish, what have you been watching this week?
Well, you know what I've been watching, Amy. You know I'm watching.
Why is everybody talking about The Upside Down? I have no idea what that is. Make it go away.
Would you please just watch the first season? Just watch the first season, please.
I refuse. Now that everybody's talking about it, I definitely
can't.
Oh,
you're one of those people that's like, well, everyone else is talking about it. You're such an elitist, please. Okay. I'm watching Stranger Things right now. I'm like halfway through the season. It's so good. Although I will say, I know, I'm going to say it. Amy made a mention last week that she had heard that it was categorized as horror. And I said, based on the first season, I wouldn't say that that is an appropriate classification. But now halfway through the second season, there definitely are some horror elements. Mm-hmm. I am willing to say it. So you're welcome, Amy.
Thank you, Nish.
For conceding the point. It is still amazing and you should still watch it. That's my opinion. The other thing that I wanted to point people towards, if you do not already follow him, first of all, everyone should be on Twitter. Well, maybe not everybody. Not everyone should be on Twitter. Let me walk back that statement. Twitter's a great place for a lot of people. One of my favorite follows on Twitter is also one of my favorite actors, Ryan Reynolds. And he is at Van City Reynolds. And he is hilarious, especially when he talks about parenting. Just the other day, he tweeted, my kids tries to surprise me for my birthday this morning. I totally heard them coming and snuck out to start a new life somewhere else. And he has all these, like,
his parenting tweets are the best.
His parenting tweets are amazing, but he is just very quick-witted, really funny. Definitely worth a follow. I always, always laugh every time he tweets something. So you should follow him. Also, he's not hard to look at. Can I say that? I said it to my husband. He knows how I feel about Ryan Reynolds.
I'm sure he loved that.
What are you watching and paying attention to this week, Amy?
So I have been watching because I have small children, but also because I constantly try to get them away from watching Paw Patrol. Not that it's bad for them, just...
But they'll be there on the double, Amy.
Oh, my God. I cannot get that song out of my head. There will be nights I wake up at 2 in the morning and it's Paw Patrol, get there on the double.
I know. Oh, we both have small children, if you can't tell. We both have preschoolers.
So there are all sorts of BBC cartoons that I love. Shout out to Charlie and Lola and Sarah and Duck.
And Wallace and Gromit.
Oh, Wallace and Gromit. But Shaun the Sheep right now is our very favorite family cartoon for a number of reasons.
So
I will tick them off very quickly. One, it is good for all ages. I have a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old. And they watch a lot of things together. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the 3-year-old, he will be cracking up and I will ask him if he knew what just happened. And he is like, no, mama, I was not following it. But what I love about Shaun the Sheep is it's wordless. There's, you know, a fair amount of slapstick humor. But they will be cracking up. And then my mom, who is about to turn 70 when she is visiting with us, will also be begging to watch Shaun the Sheep. So really from 3 to 70, everybody is happy with Shaun the Sheep. It is legitimately very funny. But the second thing I really love about it is that it's 6 minutes long. As are Sarah and Duck episodes, as are Peppa Pig, and we can talk about just the weirdness of the Peppa Pig universe sometime.
Just the weirdness of kids' cartoons in general.
I enjoy all of these that are very short, because that way, you know, I'm not going to give in if they're begging to watch a like 25-minute cartoon, but I don't feel bad about 6 minutes. I don't feel bad about letting him, if he had a very good morning getting ready and out of the house for school, letting him watch a Shaun the Sheep episode after we drop off his sister and before we get to his school. So I recommend it. It's funny. It's short. You will love it.
Okay, so tell me, this is going to be the big thing for parents. Where can you stream it for free? Is it available for streaming? Is it on Netflix? Is it Amazon? Tell us where you can watch it. Or do you have to download and pay for the episodes?
Well, I will admit that I did just pay Comcast for the Halloween special, which was essentially like 7 or 8 episodes put together, because let me tell you, we have already gotten our money's worth out of that thing.
Is it on demand? Can you do it on like cable on demand?
It is possible. Maybe. It is possible, but mostly we just steal it on YouTube.
There you go. Oh, YouTube. So there are some episodes on mm-hmm. YouTube. Okay, great. My kids love Shaun the Sheep too. It's really cute. Okay. That's all for this week's episode. Thanks for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please subscribe and visit us on Facebook at Impolite Company, the podcast. We'd love to hear from you and get your feedback. And we'll post links to our show notes as well on our website. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.